You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, it's not usually news when the mayor of a city buys a newspaper. In the case of New York's Mike Bloomberg and the Financial Times, it might be a bit more important than that. We'll ask if Bloomberg is really planning to corner the business news market.
I think the rumours are solid in terms of what Michael Bloomberg would want. He's long admired the Financial Times and The Economist. So he's got the emotional connection, which for the newspaper industry is always important.
In Ghana, following Friday's elections, the vanquished opposition are declining to shake hands and wish the returned incumbent luck. Has the familiar West African spectre of vote rigging spread to one of the region's better organised democracies, or are President John Mahama's adversaries just sore losers? In Egypt, rather than complain about this Saturday's constitutional referendum afterwards, opponents of President Mohamed Morsi are announcing in advance that they're not going to show up in the first place. But do boycotts ever really work? Japan slips narrowly but technically back into recession. We'll find out what impact this is having on the streets of Tokyo.
As long as I've been in Japan, people have been talking about Japan being in recession, and I have to say it's the most invisible recession you could imagine.
In the United Kingdom, proposed changes to secondary education would sideline creative subjects. This might please parents who'd rather their children were studying history and science than macrame and interpretive dance, but what will it cost Britain's vibrant and lucrative creative industries? Plus, we'll stop for lunch in New York and play a couple of tunes as well, all coming up in the next hour here on Midori House on Monocle 24. But before all that, we have the news headlines with Bill Wingham.
Monocle 24 News. The presidents of the EU's three main institutions have collected the Nobel Peace Prize in Norway's capital, Oslo. The EU was awarded the prize for its role in uniting Europe after two world wars. Critics say the award is inappropriate. They say the Eurozone crisis has exposed deep divisions in the 27-nation community. Nobel Committee Chairman Thorbjørn Jagland told the audience the countries of Europe must continue to stand together.
Without this European cooperation, the result might easily have been new protectionism, new nationalism, with the risk that the ground gained would be lost. Reconciliation between Germany and France is probably the most dramatic example in history to show that war and conflict can be turned so rapidly into peace and cooperation.
Italy's Prime Minister Mario Monti is playing down speculation he's about to resign. He says he's concentrating on completing his mandate before elections next year. Italy's main stock index earlier fell over 2.25% following reports he was to leave office and that former Premier Silvio Berlusconi was to stand for election again. Mr. Berlusconi's People of Freedom Party withdrew its support from the government on Thursday, which prompted the election in February. Political analyst Professor James Walston of the American University says Italy's current political instability could prove damaging to the country.
Italy loses, the European Union loses, and the euro loses. It increases instability, but it does mean that it will be over possibly by the end of February, if there's a serious result. If there's no serious result, no clear-cut result, then this whole process, painful process, will continue.
The United Nations has launched a $65 million US dollar aid appeal to help the thousands of people in the Philippines affected by Typhoon Bopha. More than 600 people have died as a result of the storm, which has left millions more without food and shelter. At least 900 people remain missing, including 300 fishermen, as landslides and floods wiped out entire communities in the south of the country. The UN says it will provide immediate aid, as well as long-term support for the southern region of Mindanao, which was hardest hit. The centre-left coalition of Prime Minister Victor Ponta has won a clear victory in Romania's general election. The Social Liberal Union polled almost 60% of the vote, with 4/5 of ballots counted. The Right Romania Alliance of centre-right president Traian Băsescu came a distant second with about 17%. The result could open the door to a constitutional crisis. As the country's president has suggested, he may refuse to reappoint his arch-rival. The Flight Attendants Union at Cathay Pacific Airways has voted for industrial action if their request for a higher pay rise is ignored. The FAU's chairwoman, Dora Lay, who represents around two-thirds of the Hong Kong-based carrier's flight attendants in the city, says they won't strike during the busy Christmas holiday season, but could implement work-to-rule measures that would limit services. But Ms. Lay says Cathay's management must return to the negotiating table.
If our escalate action still being disregarded by Cathay management, then we have no choice but to declare a strike at the appropriate time, if needed. And all the consideration of the timing, we will take Hong Kong public as number one priority. We will allow sufficient time for the public to reschedule their flight if necessary.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Bill. 6 minutes past 1800 hours here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Londres. Isto é Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Via Monocle, 26.
From London,
London,
Canada.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House live from the clearly multilingual polyglot Midori House in London. There's not much Mike Bloomberg, New York's billionaire mayor, couldn't buy if he really wanted it. However, a media outlet specialising in financial and business news would seem an unlikely priority, given that he already has one very good one and it's named after him and everything. However, reports out of New York suggest that His Honour is considering bidding for the Financial Times Group, which would add to Bloomberg's portfolio the newspaper of the same name and a half share in The Economist. Earlier, I asked media analyst Stephen Armstrong how plausible these rumours sounded and what such a takeover might mean.
I think the rumours are solid in terms of what Michael Bloomberg would want. He's long admired the Financial Times and The Economist, which are 50% owned by the Financial Times. So he's got the emotional connection, which for the newspaper industry is always important, because if you think about the history of oligarchs in newspapers, it's a passion project, really. But he also got the desire, based on the complicated performance of the Bloomberg terminals recently and how a high-profile brand attached would give a great reputation advantage in this competitive war for information in city dealing rooms and this kind of thing. Now, the thing is, would Pearson sell it? Pearson is selling off a lot of stuff. It's shedding parts of its publishing empire. It's retrenching and rethinking. So it's not inconceivable, and there certainly are strong rumours that Pearson's looking to sell. It's not formally put the paper up for auction. So it could be that this doesn't happen. Having said that, in newspapers, everyone talks to each other all the time. So when you hear, for instance, that Rupert Murdoch is thinking of making a bid for the Los Angeles Times and Herald Tribune, then you can be fairly certain that the conversations that are going on are more than just a puff of smoke.
You mentioned there the sentimental attachment or fondness that Bloomberg has for the FT and The Economist, and you're quite right. Newspapers and publishing, more than most businesses, I think, especially in these days when very few newspapers make any money, sentiment is an underrated component even of the thinking of blood-drinking oligarchs. But there must be a sort of sensible financial aspect to this. Would Bloomberg make money by owning the FT and half The Economist?
Yes, I mean, the Financial Times makes money and has a very adventurous and interesting aspect to online pricing, something that a lot of newspapers have been respectfully admiring of in this time, in this age when newspapers have been giving their content away for free. The Financial Times haven't perfected the model, but certainly other papers, the Wall Street Journal, for instance, have been doing better at it. The New York Times has come on to this, and the Times and the Sunday Times in the UK. But the Financial Times, it's not going to make the kind of money as a standalone print operation that you'd want if you were, if we look at the way that News Corporation has split its print and digital, film operations aside, print is not a massive growth business. So it's a question that shareholders aren't going to be desperately looking for new print acquisitions. But for sort of people like Murdoch, people like Bloomberg, people like, well, the traditional newspaper oligarch, then it's still a powerful prestige project and gives people enormous clout. A newspaper still is an enormously powerful way of making your feelings known.
You mentioned there the Wall Street Journal and the fact that it, like the FT, there's a perception that these two newspapers are insulated from the pressures that are destroying other newspapers by dint of the fact that they produce a specialist product which people with money are willing to pay for. How is that conventional wisdom holding up?
It's not holding up too badly, actually. I mean, the main thing about the internet is if you to look at it as any other media. I mean, as the internet, like big internet players like Google and so forth, often like to talk about how they're competing directly with old media. In actual fact, the internet is incredibly down market. So what you don't find is people who are, let's say, CEOs or people who are senior management or people at city dealing desks. They don't spend their time roaming around online. What they don't have, what they need, is a curator, a content curator, someone who can say, of all this stuff that's being created every second, this is the stuff you need to know. And established brands are the ones that can still do this. It's very hard to launch a brand new brand. People have come and gone. Motley Fool launched as a financial advice sheet, and it still exists, but it doesn't have the prestige that something like the Financial Times or the Wall Street Journal has, or you know, the way that Vogue, for instance, still has that kind of clout when it comes to saying, don't look at any of this other stuff, look at what we suggest. And that model, in fact, is becoming increasingly attractive. The Times and the Sunday Times, the New York Times, are finding that when you specialize your product, and when you get those higher-end readers paying for the online access and shutting out the kind of the noise of the rest of it, then you start to get very, very attractive audiences. The Times and the Sunday Times in the UK, and, you know, full disclosure, I do freelance for the Sunday Times, their online readership is enormously high profile. It's ABs, thousands and thousands of them, the kind of readers that magazines and newspapers would do anything for.
The acquisition of these two titles, that is the acquisition of the FT and Half the Economist, when added to Bloomberg's already considerable empire of business media, would make him extraordinarily powerful in that sector. What effect might that centralization of global business news have on global business?
I think once you get a very powerful, particularly a high personality, high profile personality like Michael Bloomberg in charge of an enormous amount of information, for a start, it's probably only American democracy that could reliably support that kind of setup, and it's probably only someone with the kind of somewhere like the kind of standard issue, generic investigative reporting that the American journalists have, where you wouldn't automatically assume corruption. But the obvious problem is, if one person can control all that information, what's to stop them? We've seen that all markets have failed over the past 5 to 6 years in terms of controlling mistaken information. One thing it might do is it might open up the option for a powerful rival to launch, which would be intriguing if, in one sense, centralization then opens up an attractive market for a new operator. You could see other players spinning off their coverage or their financial reporting. And certainly the financial reporting is the big moneymaker of the media industry in the last 5 or 6 years, because that's where the stories have come from. Whether Michael Bloomberg's the kind of guy who's going to want to control, then I don't think so. I don't think he's going to want to buy and control pricing information for his own personal reasons. I think we've seen in his personality over the last, you know, two terms as a New York mayor that he does have very strongly held beliefs, and he's prepared to take lines which appear to be right as opposed to what he feels would do the best for him. Certainly if a man was interested purely in power and corruption, he wouldn't have restricted the size of the drinks that New Yorkers could have in takeaways. So I think it's probably he's a reasonable person to put in place the controls to stop inappropriate use of information.
You mentioned there that some of those old school print media mastheads, the Financial Times, the Economist, do still have considerable cachet. Apart from that prestige and that brand recognition, what else is attractive about the FT as far as Bloomberg's concerned?
The Financial Times gets information ahead of everybody else. In terms of briefing, if you're a Financial Times journalist, you get into every single boardroom you want. You can phone up any CEO and you could say, I'm Stephen Armstrong from the Financial Times, you'll be in there. So you're getting privileged, state-of-the-art, minute-by-minute conversational access with the people who are shaping the financial markets in London. And that's certainly, you could arguably say the leading, certainly of the top two financial centres in the world. So anyone who is in charge of the Financial Times can access that kind of information. Now, you can distribute that information in different ways for different prices, different revenue, but it's hard to overestimate the value of that access.
And that was media analyst Stephen Armstrong talking to me a bit earlier. You're listening to Midori House.
This Christmas, Monocle 24 is packing its earmuffs, mittens, sticks and skis as we head up the Alps to sunny St. Moritz for a winter retreat. We'll be bringing you a Christmas stocking full of shows, including The Briefing, Midori House and The Review. So join our editors and their guests for a festive spree of friends and family, debate and discussion, with plenty of mulled wine. From Boxing Day all the way to New Year's Day 2013, right here on Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's time now to grab a brisk lunch with our New York City Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears. Good afternoon, Aisha.
Hi, Andrew. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Well, I'm glad we've sorted all that out. We have to start probably with Tsai's visit to Tsai. I still haven't figured that one out. His visit to Washington. Loath I am to give this ghastly dance craze any more publicity, not that it really needs it at this point. There has been kind of an interesting political subtext to his visit. Has America forgiven him?
I think, we're not sure yet. So Tsai did perform at this annual Christmas concert in Washington, D.C., which is held at the National Building Museum. Obama and the First Family were in attendance, and he performed a Christmas song. So instead of saying Gangnam Style, he said Christmas Style, which obviously turns the whole song around and makes it a new pop hit, which everyone can listen to. And it does follow from the news a few days earlier that, you know, he had sung some anti-American lyrics at a 2004 protest concert. I don't think much was made of it. He seemed apologetic. Obama basically just shook his hand, and the White House have issued saying, you know, we weren't involved with the actual booking of the concert. It's just tradition for the president to attend it. So it wasn't like an official apology, and who knows? I mean, if anyone's actually listening to Tsai's political beliefs, then they should be maybe looking elsewhere anyway.
Indeed. But this is the sort of thing that during the election campaign would certainly have been turned into a thing by Obama's opponents. Is anyone trying, or is everyone just exhausted at this point and looking forward to Christmas?
Not really. I think they're trying to turn everything else they can into a thing. So, no, this hasn't really been picked up by anyone. The concert doesn't actually air until December 21st, so possibly then things will be said. But no, I don't think anyone's really kind of taking the shot of Obama shaking hands with Tsai and blasting him yet.
Okay, well, looking away from New York slightly to something that is a thing or will be a thing, because one of the key battlegrounds of that presidential election ended up being in New Jersey, where Governor Chris Christie, to I'm sure the enduring rage of Mitt Romney, who won't be sending him a Christmas card this year, decided to get all friendly with President Obama shortly before the polling date. But Cory Booker, the mayor of Newark, fancies a tilt at Christie.
Indeed. So Newark Mayor Cory Booker, who's and has been in the press a lot, as has Christie, over the recovery efforts from Hurricane Sandy, was on Face the Nation this weekend, a TV show on CBS, where he told the host that he'll be deciding over the next 10 days whether or not he'll run for either New Jersey governor next year or for the U.S. Senate in 2014. This is obviously big news. Cory Booker is a national figure, even though he's only the mayor of a city in New Jersey. He's currently in the middle of a kind of press battle trying to oppose the cuts in Congress that are being proposed to food stamps. So he's been living on food stamps for the week to kind of highlight how difficult it is to do that. He's very active on social media. He's a leader of a young kind of Democrat leader in the party. So he will be facing up against Chris Christie possibly, but we'll know more in a few days' time.
Well, tell us a bit more about Cory Booker. How has somebody who is, with all due respect to Newark, the mayor of a somewhat unprepossessing city in New York, in New Jersey rather, become the national figure you describe?
Well, he's a bit, you know, he's a big supporter of Obama. I think there's a lot to be said for the fact that he is an African-American man, and so he ties into that very much. So he really is very vocal, though. So he will interact with people who interact with him on social media, which has given him this huge public face. He's a great spokesperson for the Obama administration, and I think he's a young leader in the Republican Party, and we'll definitely be seeing a lot more from him over the next decade or so.
Okay, well, returning back to your immediate bailiwick, the city of New York, London, as most people probably well aware, have a very fairly successful at this point bike share bike hire scheme known as the Boris Bike. I understand the Mike Bike is still failing to launch.
The Mike Bike has been failing to launch for the last year and a half or so. So this is a long saga that New Yorkers, I think, are very bored with now. Who knows if we'll get these bikes? They'll be called City Bikes because they're sponsored by Citibank. We were supposed to have them in the summer. I think we were supposed to have about 10,000 bikes this year across 600 stations. That was delayed. There's been all sorts of talks about why things have been delayed, to do with kind of technological failure. And Bloomberg stood up there and gave a press conference about it. The latest saga is now that because of Hurricane Sandy, we won't be getting them until May next year. And at that, it'll only be a reduced number. So about 5,000 bikes in May of 2013. They're saying it's because a lot of the equipment was damaged during the storm because it was being stored in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. But who knows? It really doesn't seem that New York's going to get a bike share for a very long time.
See, Hurricane Sandy is quite a good reason for something to be delayed. It was a very, very big and dangerous and damaging storm. But prior to the storm striking, what had actually been the holdup? I mean, this does seem to be a bit one of those, you know, how hard can it be stories.
There had been a holdup saying that the actual equipment, the computer equipment, there was a glitch in the system, so they'd held up on that. There's been a number of excuses to do with how much funding has been in place. Alta didn't deliver. Alta, who's the company who make the bikes in Montreal based, who also run the system in Washington, D.C., they hadn't delivered the bikes in the way that they were supposed to be delivered. Two-thirds of the bikes were stored in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, so obviously some stuff did get damaged, but it's the kind of thing which eventually, when it does actually hit the streets of New York, I think a lot of people will be surprised that it made it.
And just finally, I know you wanted to talk about this as well. New York Magazine's list of reasons to love New York in 2012 had an interesting entry at number 46.
It did. Well, this is an annual list that New York Magazine puts out, the weekly magazine puts out, reasons to love New York. And number 46, I mean, alongside things of Hillary Clinton might be coming back to the region, Governor Cuomo is a leader on environmental issues, more serious things, it has something where you can find pretty much any support group that you may want to find in New York City, from the New York City Hoarders No More meetup services to the Brave Artists of New York City, to the Herpes Recovery Anonymous of New York City. All of these things, gay men's social anxiety support group, all of these things meet regularly in New York, which I think is a hilarious thing to kind of put in a list of reasons to love the city.
You mentioned New York City Hoarders No More meetup. There's also a Clutterers Anonymous. They should get together.
They should. They should probably learn from each other. One could parent the other one, buddy up, buddy system. Isn't that
exactly
how they do it?
Yeah, there's the Sugar Free Support Group, Under Earners Anonymous,
the NYC Narcissist Support Group. next to the Wallflower Power, they should be together. The Narcissists and the Wallflowers.
They should really get together. The Borderline Personality Disorder Support Group. I bet their Christmas dinner's a ripper.
I'm kind of ready to go to one of these and check out which thing I could actually sign up to.
Perhaps not so much the Woman's Anger Group. I get enough of that at home, etc. Aisha Spears, thank you very much as ever for joining us. That's our New York City Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears. You're listening to the Midori House on Monocle 24 and staying very much in New York. This is Ryan Adams with the song of the same name. Ryan Adams with New York, New York. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. By the none too stringent standards of West Africa, Ghana has long been regarded as something of a model of a relatively stable, more or less uncorrupt, tentatively progressing democracy. Not for nothing did Barack Obama honour Ghana back in 2009 with his first visit to Africa. The aftermath of last Friday's presidential and parliamentary elections has served as a reminder that Ghana, for all its virtues, remains very much a work in progress. The incumbent president, John Mahama, hung narrowly onto power, but opposition parties are claiming that the poll was fixed. Joining me now to discuss whether the protesters have a righteous case or are just sulking is Nick Norbrook from Africa Report. Nick, first of all, briefly, who is complaining and what are they complaining about?
Well, the NPP believe they have been robbed of this election. Their candidate, Nana Akufo-Addo, believes that there's been serious irregularities and rigging. The problem comes between the polling centres and the collation centres where these votes are put together. The NPP are saying they have examples of 20 different constituencies where there was one number announced at the polling centre, but when that got to the collation centre, the number was different. So they believe they have a serious case they can mount against the incumbent, current President Mahama.
Couldn't these reported glitches just have been glitches? They do happen.
They certainly do happen. However, we've been hearing a number of reports from across the country in different locations. For example, just north of Accra in the Dome Kwabena district, the candidate there of the NPP, Adwoa Safo, had to demand 9 recounts of the collated vote from the electoral committee. The Electoral Commission eventually did concede that there were 15,000 votes extra due to her, and she duly won that. That's just one example, and it's one in which the Electoral Commission backed down. So it does seem that there's maybe more than just a little bit of smoke.
You mentioned there Nana Akufo-Addo, the narrowly defeated challenger. Do he and his supporters have any legal options?
Well, he said he believes he can take this to the courts, and that's probably where they'll start. The NPP is actually a party of lawyers, lots of lawyers in that party, so it wouldn't surprise me if that's the route that they took.
And, I mean, do they have much momentum behind them? There was an extraordinarily high turnout for this election, nearly 80%, but as far as it's possible to tell, do that 80% of Ghanaians seem satisfied with the result?
Well, there was last night some angry scenes outside the Electoral Commission headquarters in Accra. There was about 200 supporters who had gathered there, very angry, but, you know, eventually peaceably dispersed. And, you know, it's eerily quiet today. It's unclear whether they have sort of a groundswell of popular opinion to take them into a different phase of this contest.
And just finally, John Mahama, the returned president, only became president earlier this year, appointed upon the death of the previous incumbent. Could this be any reflection on him? I mean, in general, does he have a reputation for probity?
There have been some corruption cases surrounding President Mahama, which have yet to be fully aired. But to be honest, he is not a character that well known to the ordinary Ghanaian. He was vice president. Everyone knew the president very well. When the vice president was shoved into the presidency, you know, this was kind of the first time that several Ghanaians had sort of paid attention to him. So he, I don't think, has that kind of personal charisma to have swayed things. A lot of people believe that there may well have been a sympathy vote towards the now deceased former president.
Thank you very much for that, Nick. That was Nick Norbrook from Africa Report on the recent elections in Ghana. In the next half hour of Midori House, Egypt's opposition threatens to boycott a constitutional vote, but we'll be asking, do boycotts ever really work? Also, are proposals to drop creative subjects from Britain's high school qualifications realism or philistinism? But before we ask those important questions, here's Bill Bingham with the news headlines.
The presidents of the EU's three main institutions have collected the Nobel Peace Prize in Norway's capital, Oslo. The EU was awarded the prize for its role in uniting Europe after two world wars. Critics say the award is inappropriate. They say the Eurozone crisis has exposed deep divisions in the 27-nation community. Italy's Prime Minister Mario Monti is playing down speculation he's about to resign. He says he's concentrating on completing his mandate before elections next year. Italy's main stock index fell earlier, over 2.25%, following reports he was to leave office and that former Premier Silvio Berlusconi was to stand for election again. The United Nations has launched a $65 million aid appeal to help the thousands of people in the Philippines affected by Typhoon Bopha. More than 600 people have died as a result of the storm, which has left millions more without food and shelter. At least 900 people remain missing, including 300 fishermen, as landslides and floods wiped out entire communities in the south of the country. The centre-left coalition of Prime Minister Victor Ponta has won a clear victory in Romania's general election. The Social Liberal Union polled almost 60% of the vote, with four-fifths of ballots counted. And the Flight Attendants Union at Cathay Pacific Airways has voted for industrial action if their request for a higher pay rise is ignored. The FAU's chairwoman, Dora Lay, who represents around two-thirds of the Hong Kong-based carrier's flight attendants in the city, says they won't strike during the busy Christmas holiday season, but could implement work-to-rule measures that could limit services. And those are the latest headlines here on Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from London with me, Andrew Muller. This Saturday, Egyptians will be asked to vote on a draft constitution, though the idea of Egyptians being asked to vote on anything should still be an invigorating novelty. Opponents of Egypt's new president, Mohamed Morsi, are urging their supporters to stay home. The logic is not difficult to distill. Rather than engage with the argument, undermine proceedings entirely by refusing to participate. Abstention of this sort has been a political tool even since before an uncompromising 19th century estate manager by the name of Charles Cunningham Boycott was shunned by allies of the Irish Land League. But how useful is it? A bit earlier, I spoke with Shadi Hamid, Director of Research for the Brookings Doha Centre and a fellow at the Saban Centre for Middle East Policy. I wanted to know if Morsi's opponents are only boycotting the vote because they know they can't win it.
I think it goes a little bit deeper than that. The opposition disagrees with how the whole entire process has been conducted. They feel that this constitution has been rammed down their throats, that they haven't been appropriately consulted. And, I mean, just before the draft was finalized, there was a walkout of liberal and non-Islamist members. So there is a kind of broader critique about the process and what the process led to, and there are a number of articles that are quite controversial. And then, of course, just this past week, there were deadly clashes outside the presidential palace, and when blood is spilled in that manner, it's very difficult to regain trust. So you see this tendency to withdraw from the entire political process. People have lost faith in the democratic process.
Which is a process which has happened very and depressingly quickly where Egypt is concerned. But in the Middle Eastern context, how much of a history and a background is to the idea of the boycott as a political tool?
The boycott has actually been a popular tool used by opposition groups in a number of cases. There have been several boycotts in Jordan by the Islamist opposition. In Egypt, there was a boycott in 1990 and a partial boycott in 2010, right before the revolution, actually. Unfortunately, boycotts don't have a great track record in the Middle East or, to be honest, anywhere. First of all, it's very difficult for the opposition to unify. That once one opposition group withdraws from the boycott decision, other groups have the incentive to withdraw as well. So it's really hard to develop a unified front and to really coordinate the position, because there is always this desire from some groups to participate so they can have parliamentary seats, so they can gain things from the government and so on. In the Middle East, there's also the most obvious example in recent years, which is Iraq. When the Sunni opposition boycotted early on in that country's transition, if you want to call it that, that was a major mistake. Major mistake because they didn't have a stake in what happened after. They were isolated. They weren't properly represented in elected bodies. So that actually pushed elements of the Sunni opposition to violence because they didn't have buy-in in the democratic process. That's why it's very important early on for opposition groups to feel they have a stake in the process. Otherwise, they have an incentive to play spoiler.
I mean, there are, of course, examples in history of boycotts of one sort or another that have been successful. You think, obviously, of things like the Montgomery bus boycott in the 1950s, which was the beginning of the US civil rights movement. Even thinking recently, in the last few weeks, just here in the United Kingdom, almost as a bid to stave off a boycott, you saw Starbucks deciding to come to some sort of terms with the British government and actually offer to pay a reasonable amount of tax. Does the boycott depend on there being, and that's something that doesn't often exist in the Middle East, a media free enough to report that it's actually happening?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, it's important to distinguish between general boycotts and election boycotts. I think there are different aspects to each, but where boycotts can work is in terms of threatening the government to offer concessions. So there are a lot of cases where the opposition boycotts, the government responds positively, and you see a resolution to the crisis, and the opposition groups re-enter the political process. And that's where actually there is a good track record, because governments benefit from greater legitimacy. They want to be able to point and say, opposition parties did participate. This was a vote where different elements had a voice, and so on. So I think that it is a very good negotiating tool.
But how widespread does the boycott need to be before it's actually effective? Obviously, a government can ignore a small boycott by a small number of people, as indeed an Olympic Games can soldier on with a boycott of a few countries. But when large numbers boycott, as we saw happen in 1980 and 1984, it does kind of delegitimize the event. What sort of support do you need if you're trying to run a political boycott of the sort that Morsi's opponents are?
Yeah, that's you point to a critical thing here, that there is a tipping point where the opposition becomes a critical mass. It becomes noticeable. It becomes something people can't ignore. That makes the Egyptian case a little bit challenging, because there isn't a clear sense of how strong the opposition is. First of all, it's still divided. There are different elements. There are liberals, socialists, revolutionaries, old regime elements. So it's very hard to know to what extent they're going to be able to speak with a common voice. And right now you actually see a split where some are talking about a boycott and some are talking about voting no. So considering that, it's unlikely to reach a critical mass where it really depresses turnout. And that's a really important thing to watch here. How high or how low will the turnout figures be?
You mentioned there the fact, and you're right, of course, that governments, ideally for a government, is that there's a huge turnout, there's an opposition in place, and they win, and everybody's happy because then they're a legitimate government. But for the opposition that's boycotted something like a constitutional referendum, how hard is it for them to then come back and be an opposition? Because the government can, of course, then say to them, look, there was an important question being asked here last weekend, and you guys didn't turn up for that, so why should we listen to you now?
Yeah, that's why there's a real risk of marginalization, that once you set the precedent of boycotting and withdrawing from the political process, it becomes more difficult to re-enter. And you're going to have another conversation just in a couple months when Egypt holds parliamentary elections. And I mean, my worry would be that if you see a lot of groups boycotting this time, there may be a similar decision to consider boycotting the next time. And then you're really going to have a situation where the opposition is marginalized from parliament and state institutions in general. And that could be dangerous for Egypt's transition. So I think the parliamentary elections are going to be key to watch. And, you know, we'll have to see to what extent after the referendum, the Egyptian government tries to reach out and at least perhaps offer some concessions to the opposition to kind of bring them back in.
And that was Shadi Hamid, Director of Research for the Brookings Doha Centre and a Fellow at the Saban Centre for Middle East Policy at Brookings. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with an assessment of Japan's most recent recession.
Join our team of editors and their special guests every day from New Year's Eve as they usher in 2013. From Sao Paulo to Singapore and from Abu Dhabi to Atlanta, we'll be gazing into our crystal ball to see what the fresh new year holds in store for your sector. So make your New Year's resolution to kick off 2013 with our editor's look aheads. Every weekday at 7 a.m. right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 1841 here in London. Japan's economy has slipped into recession again, it's been reported, after the government revised down GDP figures to show a 0.1% contraction. This is, of course, hardly unusual, but it is grim timing for Prime Minister Yoshihiko Noda as elections loom next week. But how does a theoretical return to recession feel on the streets of Tokyo? Monocle's Ted Kravitz caught up with Fiona Wilson, Monocle's bureau chief there, to find out.
You know, as long as I've been in Japan, people have been talking about Japan being in recession. And I have to say, it's the most invisible recession you could imagine. I mean, our office is on Omotesando, which is a very busy shopping street. It's all looking very buoyant. I have to say, we've got the Christmas lights. The big shops are all putting on full Christmas decorations. So it's not really like a recession as you know it. And actually, it's so marginal, they keep talking about this technical recession because it's so marginal that it is in recession. I think it's a big headline, mostly because of the election coming up.
That's interesting you say that then. A technical recession, and as you say, you know, it does meet the definition of a technical recession because it's only 0.1% contraction. Is there a feeling there that it could be a lot worse given the state of economies around the world?
I don't know. It's been a really tough time for Japan. There are a lot of things working against the economy at the moment. You know, not just domestically, but you've got the situation with China, which means Japanese companies there have taken a hit. What's going on in the Eurozone affects Japan. The weak recovery in the States is also affecting Japan. Mostly it means that the yen is really strong and it's hitting exports. So that's the headline, really, is that anyone trying to export anything is really suffering. And there's been a lot of talk of that recently. And Abe, who's the opposition politician who hopes to be prime minister shortly, has been talking about what he would do to reverse that.
Well, let's talk about that. The election's coming up very shortly, just towards the end of the week. And as you say, the opposition leader Shinzo Abe has been talking about greater fiscal stimulus, and he wants unlimited monetary easing to try and boost growth. All talk, or do you think actually his ideas are getting a lot of support?
Well, I think he's quite wise to talk about the economy because that's become the big issue in the election. So, you know, it looks like he's going to win, and talk about how he's going to improve the economy is obviously going to be very welcome. Now, whether he can actually do it is another matter. I mean, one of the big issues dividing the parties, the DPJ, the ruling party, and the LDP, the opposition, is the consumption tax rise. It's been a big debate here at the moment. Noda, who's the Prime Minister, has been pushing through this consumption tax rise. And a lot of the evidence points to the fact that one of the impacts of the consumption tax rise is a recession. This is what happened in Japan last time when they did that in 97. So I think a lot of people are a bit worried about what effect it would have. It's supposed to go up by 2015. It's going up it's a gradation. It goes up in 2014, then 2015. I think people are worried about that. There are a lot of other issues going on at the moment around the economy. That's just one of them. Parliament passed a stimulus package last month, but so many factors working against the economy at the moment that it's hard to see a way out at the moment.
The consumption tax is an interesting one, isn't it? It affects not only tourists who come to Japan, who are already hit by the exchange rate, which you just referred to a little earlier, but also residents and those already living and being paid in yen. Is it very unpopular on the street?
It's mixed. I think a lot of people face the fact that Japan has an enormous social services bill. I mean, how is Japan going to pay for this increasing number of pensioners? Yeah. Something doesn't add up with the figures. And a lot of people have said, including Noda, the Prime Minister, look, we have to face facts here. We don't have the money to support all these people. We have to raise tax somehow. And consumption tax was the way he chose to do it. It's not wildly unpopular. I think it's just as the economy is struggling and with what's happened with China, the big companies that are usually very buoyant have been talking about some poor results. Honda was saying they're downgrading their results forecast, so is Sharp. And I think it's just it creates a certain mood, which is not very positive.
Okay, well, you said a little earlier, I just want to finish by picking you up on this, as the elections loom, that Yoshihiko Noda is expected to lose. What kind of person is Yoshihiko Noda? How is he regarded by ordinary Japanese on the street? Is he popular?
I mean, no Japanese politician is wildly popular, it has to be said. I mean, I think the thing about Noda is he's just one of a, you know, revolving door of politicians who've become prime minister. None of them particularly wanted the job, I have to say. There are very few people who really seem to want it. Shinzo Abe is a bit of an exception. He does look like he'd like to have a second go because he's already been prime minister. Mm. I think Noda is, for a lot of people, the DPJ has been a big disappointment. It was such an extraordinary thing when they won with this landslide victory in 2009. People had really high hopes. This was going to change Japanese politics. And it turned out it didn't. We've had three prime ministers in 3 years. Obviously, the catastrophe in March 2011, which many people felt the DPJ just didn't handle that well. I think there's a big sense of disappointment for a lot of people who felt they'd really been promised a clean sweep of Japanese politics. It just hasn't quite happened. And to see Shinzo Abe returning only reinforces that idea. You know, he's very much from the ruling political class. He's the son and grandson of politicians. He's been prime minister already. So it feels like a slightly backward step, although obviously he wouldn't say that. But that's how I think most people are viewing it at the moment. There's a feeling of apathy, slightly depressed apathy about politics.
And that was Monocle's Asia Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson in Tokyo talking to Ted Kravitz. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Got time for another song now. From Brooklyn, this is Firehorse with Our Hearts. That was Firehorse with Our Hearts. And you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. It's faintly incredible, really, that education is always the subject of such rancour. Everybody is in favour of it, aside perhaps from a minority of hardcore delinquents and Pink Floyd, but there is little agreement about the best means of inculcating it. In the United Kingdom, the present big idea of the current government is the replacement of the General Certificate of Secondary Education, or GCSE, with something called the English Baccalaureate, or EBAC. This new qualification focuses exclusively on academic subjects and excludes creative ones, which is arguably kind of weird when one considers that the arts are a field in which Britain appears to have a demonstrative aptitude. Well, joining me now to discuss the impact this would have on Britain's creative industries is Joe McLeod, who's the creative director at digital design studio Us2. Good evening, Joe.
Hi.
Briefly outline the difference, if you will, between the status quo and what the government is suggesting.
So at the moment, lots of people study all sorts of different creative subjects in schools, and I think we all really enjoy that. Certainly I've got kids there and I want them to learn a lot of creative subjects. At the moment, the proposal is that we will bias a lot of the more, academic type of subjects, which would be English, maths, humanities, languages and science. And sideline many of the arts and creative subjects, so drama, design technology, performing arts, and etc. So, and one of those which is outlined is also design technology, which I think is a particularly peculiar one.
This does seem bizarre. The government is as presumably aware as anybody that these industries are worth, by some estimations, £33.5 billion a year to the British economy. Why are they doing this? Are they just a collection of Philistines, or is there an economic rationale to this as far as they see it?
There was some sort of rationale about it. I think the education qualifications have grown a lot over the past 10, 15 years. So I think about 10 years ago, there was probably about 15,000 GCSEs offered to students. Now they've diversified into like nearly like 200,000 or something like that. I can't remember the numbers, which is a problem, but it isn't the same problem they're trying to solve with getting creative subjects out of the education, which is a very different proposition.
So what effect do you think a kind of discouragement of this sort of study at high school level would have on the business you work in?
So for us in particular, my real concerns are that it devalues design, which, as you point out, we're one of the leaders in the world and certainly one of the leaders in Europe of design. We've grown in the last, in this recession, we've grown 29%, which means that we require to get a lot of graduates into our industry, and they have to be the best quality graduates to keep us at that tip-top sort of world-leading ranking. If we don't have people who are engaged in design at an education level, and we don't get that sort of those graduates coming out, that's going to undermine our industry.
You'd also presumably agree with the argument that even if the students are pursuing academic subjects, then some sort of creative education is a good thing, even for somebody who wants to be a scientist or an engineer.
I think that's a really good point. And one of the ones which hasn't been discussed so much is that the rounded mindset of anyone trying to think about things in the world and solve solutions, the way you think about subjective matters like the arts, like drama and design, is an important way to solve solutions, whether they be in maths or in chemistry or science or etc.
Is there any way you think that your sector can talk the government down on this?
Well, we've been doing this campaign for about 6 weeks, and we started with a small group of similar studios around Shoreditch, which is where we are. It grew really rapidly. Within 2 weeks, we got up to like 40 studios. Some of the world leading IDEO was in within 1 week. We had Interbrand, Fitch, and last week we got Johnny Ive and Stella McCartney in, and Foster and Partners. So it's growing. Everyone's engaged. We haven't had anyone criticising us for doing this. Everyone's enormously passionate and want to do something really compelling to try and get this sixth pillar into the into education. The sixth pillar being the creative arts.
Is there any sense that the government are inclined to listen to you?
Well, I think Grove hears stuff. I don't know how much he listens. He has had a lot of criticism from all sorts of groups. One of them is the select committee he's meant to listen to. He hasn't been listening to the teachers' unions. He hasn't been listening to a number of different groups. We've certainly have had difficulty getting him listening and his groups listening through the Design Council, who we've been working with quite closely.
I mean, so another obvious criticism against this plan is that it would leave the creative fields to become the exclusive province of the rich and privately educated, but it's hard to see that this government is going to regard that as that much of a criticism.
Yeah, actually, I don't think it'll even be for them to study it. It'll be so devastating, I don't think anyone will be studying it. If you look at who's started to cut this out of their curriculum, last year 27% of schools started to cut it, and the year before, 45% of schools started to cut creative subjects in bias towards the EBAC ones.
A trend that I think I'm right in saying it's OK to say that we hope here at Monocle 24 can be reversed. Joe McLeod, Creative Director at US2, thank you very much for joining us. And that's all we have time for today on Midori House. Thanks to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Culture with Robert Bound is up next. He'll be looking at art theft as a subject rather than a career move. In 3 hours' time at 2200 hours, I'll be back with Tom Burgess Watson for the Monocle Daily, and I'll be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. Until then, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.